KDLL Public Radio provides the news, interviews, features, and entertainment programming you trust from around the world and right here at home. Do you value local, responsible reporting or diverse music brought to you by your friends and neighbors? How about in-depth shows that are unique to your community? Then please support KDLL. We can't continue to bring you the local programming you enjoy without your support. Please visit kdll.org and click the donate button today.
We're talking about the MOV bacteria, Bacterium Mycoplasma ovi pneumonia, which is a mouthful, and I do not recommend saying it more than once at a time in a row. In the studio, I've got Amy Seitz of the Alaska Farm Bureau, and on the phone, I've got state veterinarian Dr. Bob Gerlach. How are you both doing today?
Doing great, and we appreciate you having us on here.
Yeah. Bob, are you there?
Yes, I sure am. Sounds great, and glad to be on the line with you.
Terrific. Well, I probably horribly mispronounced the name of the MOV bacteria. Bob, maybe you could tell us what it is and why it's so dangerous to us. From your perspective.
Okay, it's the bacterium is Mycoplasma ovi pneumonia, and it's part of a family of bacteria that affect mammals, and there's a number of different strains. I mean, there's the Mycoplasma ovi pneumonia was thought to be just a bacteria that affected sheep and goats and related species, but we also have an outbreak of Mycoplasma pneumonia in beef. It's the Mycoplasma bovis, and it causes some similar symptoms in beef cows at a pneumonia. But if it gets into bison, it can cause extremely severe problems, and that's kind of what we're seeing with this Mycoplasma ovi pneumonia as well.
Wow. I did look up ovi. And at first I thought it was eggs. I thought, oh, this is the Latin word for eggs. But it's ovines, right? Like sheep and goats are ovines.
Yep.
Amy is nodding her head here. Yeah, do you have sheep and goats?
I have sheep. Yes.
Oh, okay. Are they tasty?
They are. And they provide really nice wool.
Oh, yeah, that's probably the best part. So Bob, is this an endemic thing to the critters in this area, the wild critters, or was it brought in by, I don't know, the wood bison that they transplanted here 10 years ago? Or where are we on the grand spectrum of ovi pneumonia?
The ovi pneumonia, that was a question that no one knew, or not a question, but an answer no one knew. It was suspected initially that it was a bacteria that was brought in with domestic animals to North America. That's been the working hypothesis for quite a while, until the study that was done up here in Alaska, where we have found the Mycoplasma ovi pneumonia not just in domestic animals, but also in wildlife and wild species. And these are some wildlife populations that are far from interaction with any domestic species. So what we're trying to determine is, with more work and research on looking at the genetic structure of this bacteria, whether this may be a normal bacterium that circulates in wildlife. And it also has different strains that may circulate in domestic animals.
You know, I was looking at some of the information about this, and the mortality of this in some wild stock, some herds, was incredibly high.
That's true, and that's one of the concerns has been studied in the lower 48 for quite a while. For at least the last 20 to probably close to 40 years, was the pneumonia issue in bighorn sheep. And it was suspected that there was probably a multitude of bacteria that were involved in these mortality events. But when you look actually at the mortality events, it's not widespread. These are sporadic and focal pneumonia episodes that occur that can have prolonged impact on the population of wild animals. So it can have a pretty high mortality rate or death rate. In some cases, it can go ahead and infect young animals that continue to go ahead and spread it, so that there can be a prolonged impact on the population in some of these isolated areas.
Wow. Amy, let me ask you, first, what is the Alaska Farm Bureau?
We're a nonprofit organization. Our big focus is ag-friendly policy. So we advocate for healthy family farms in the state, try to build the economic viability of agriculture up here. And then also there's a national organization also. So every state has a Farm Bureau and then the national organization. So our main focus is on having farms and building our agriculture system.
Seems to be more and more in Alaska.
Well, yeah, we're getting back up there. We used to, you know, provide 50% of our food, and now we're down to, you know, 2 to 5%.
Wait, really?
So we're
50%?
Yeah, in the early days, yeah, we used to provide a lot of our own food.
But the early farming days,
or early Alaska days.
Oh well, yeah. But do you call folks who have sheep and goats ranchers or farmers? I don't want to offend either one by calling.
I think up here we call them farmers.
Okay. Yeah. So goat farmers like yourself. What does this MOVI bacteria do for you?
Do for us? Well, and actually, until 2016, when it came before the Board of Game, I hadn't heard of MOVI. You know, it wasn't on our radar. So yeah, it was kind of a learning curve, and like Dr. Gerlach mentioned, there's a lot of unanswered questions still, so we're all learning as we go. And originally, you know, one of the aspects is there were a lot of regulations being proposed to sheep and goat owners, so that's one aspect of what MOV started to mean, is we were going to be regulated heavily.
Fences, right?
Fences, permitting, testing, testing import, you know, there were quite a few recommended regulations put out there.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, all of those would add cost to raising animals in an already expensive state. So that was, you know, having regulations put on us when we didn't understand a pathogen and how it worked. And you know, now that we're discovering it's not just in sheep and goats, it's in moose, caribou. So that, you know, if you look at it, if we had put in regulations on domestic sheep and goats and not looked at these other animals, we may not have stopped anything, but, you know, put financial burdens on our farmers.
Mm-hmm. Thinking about this among farmers evolved since 2016?
Yes. And, you know, farmers, when we first learned about it, you know, of course, nobody wants to harm our doll sheep or mountain goats, but, you know, we know our situation in Alaska is different than the other Western states. You know, the loss of habitat for the bighorn sheep is different than what our doll sheep have up here. The different stressors down in the Western state, you know, loss of habitat, human interaction. There's a lot more people down in the states than there are up here. So just a whole different situation. But obviously, as a farmer, as a sheep or a goat owner, the health of our animals is important. So we wanted to find out more about the pathogen, you know, just for good husbandry. The current study that Dr. Gerlach is working on is answering some questions, but also bringing up more questions.
It has the farming community started thinking more favorably about standardized testing and such among their livestock, or Or is that not a good idea? Let me ask you that. Because to me, it's you know, I'm an innocent bystander here. It sounds like a good idea, but maybe it's not.
Well, and if it's allowing people to have the option to test, like there's all sorts of pathogens out there. I mean, we could spend millions testing for every pathogen out there. But keeping a close eye on your flock, making sure they're healthy, having the option to test, and that's one thing is getting a validated test so it's consistent, you know, because the mycoplasma, and Dr. Gerlach can explain more about how you test for mycoplasmas, but, you know, it's not like going in and testing for strep.
More involved is what you're saying.
Yeah, and a fairly new pathogen, you have to develop a consistent testing process so you get a result that you can count on. Mm-hmm. But then you also have to look at the cost, you know, and right now I think it's $50 per sample per animal, and they recommend 3 samples per animal. And I think to be able to claim MOB free, it has to be 2 sets of 3 samples in a year. So you're looking at, you know, $300 per animal just for the testing, not the vet visit, the other costs that go along with it.
Right. Does that put you at odds with wildlife managers?
I don't know that it puts us at odds with wildlife managers. I think we both want to get answers, and we both want to protect our wildlife and also have healthy domestic animals. But I know there are some who think that we need to have mandatory statewide testing and call out any positives. But I think we need to get answers to know that we're making the right decision.
Oh, Bob, what do you think? Dr. Gerlach, I should say. Sorry. Getting super
thanks.
Familiar.
The question of testing is really a good one to cover, because it's one of the issues can be, as Amy mentioned, is that if an owner wants to test for a disease, they can go out and there's oftentimes a number of different types of tests that you can do, and you have diagnostic labs that can run those for you. And then some tests are developed for academic purposes, so that they're developed at universities to go ahead and help improve upon the diagnostic tests that we have. And some of those have not been, like Amy said, validated for use in animals, certain species, and you have to go ahead and show them so much data to go ahead and prove that the test you have when you run it is going to give you the correct results most of the time, and, you know, 90 or 85% of the time. And then you have the difference here between those diagnostic tests and regulatory tests. And so when you're going to go ahead and take a test and do a regulatory control program for a specific disease, like maybe brucellosis or tuberculosis, then those tests have to go through a standardized method so that any lab that runs them is going to run the same test the same way, and that way we'll go ahead and get consistency of results, so that when we go ahead and have a testing program, it doesn't matter where the lab is or where the samples are being tested. They're tested in a consistent manner so that we can go ahead and compare different regions of the state or different regions of the country or different regions of the world, because what you need to do is have proof in that the findings to make sure that, say, if you're going to have a moving animal across state lines, that the state on the other side of you has confidence in those test results. And that's a very difficult issue with respect to this mycoplasma open pneumonia. There aren't any regulatory programs for it. And so we have some diagnostic tests, and we're still trying to work through to get a good test, because the mycoplasma bacteria is very difficult to culture and grow in a culture medium. And that's kind of what we used to do. And back in the time when I was in veterinary school, our primary diagnostic tests were you cultured something and see if you could grow it and then identify it from the growth on the culture plate. This bacteria is extremely difficult to culture, and so they've developed these genetic tests to go ahead and try to make the test a little bit faster and a little bit more sensitive, because as you go ahead and collect a sample and ship it to the lab, sometimes if you don't ship it there quick enough, or if it's not held in the right temperature and in media or the proper nurturing material, then maybe you're not going to go ahead and get a good positive result, even though you had a positive animal when you took the culture. So it's a very difficult process to go through. And so what the testing that we're doing in the state now is a combination of a genetic testing as well as trying to go ahead and culture some of the samples that we're taking.
Right. Where are you getting samples from?
So the program in the state has expanded. We initially started testing domestic animals because of the concern of the Wild Sheep Foundation and the Board of Game for mycoplasma possibly getting into wild populations and causing a problem like they have seen in the lower 48. And so we were had a voluntary testing program that we offered to any animal owners that had domestic goats or sheep. And then as we started to get into the study, we were able to go ahead and work with the Department of Fish and Game and the diagnostic labs to go ahead and include wildlife in this. And so the Department of Fish and Game has been running a very big program, a collection program to go ahead and test different wildlife populations across the state. And it's been very interesting.
How urgent is this episode? I don't know if to call it an outbreak or a infestation, but how urgent is all this for folks?
I think it's important to get answers, but I mean, at this point, apart from one caribou, I think the doll sheep and mountain goats and the other wildlife that have been tested have been healthy. The same with the domestic animals. All the animals that have been tested positive are still healthy. So, it's definitely something we want to get more information on and monitor, but it's not like, you know, right now we're not having mass die-offs or anything.
Well, Jay, what I was just going to add to one thing to Amy's comments is the fact that when we first were made aware of the concern from the Board of Game and the Wild Sheep Foundation about this particular bacteria and the threat to wild animals, the first thing that we looked at was the fact that let's look at what data we have, because Fish and Game does a lot of surveillance already out in the wildlife populations. And at this point, we had not seen any morbidity or illnesses or mortality, deaths in wild animals or wild sheep or goat populations that had been attributed to mycoplasma. And so that was one of the things that we said, I don't think this is something that we need to jump in urgency, but we need to go ahead and gather data, and that way we can understand what we're dealing with so that we can approach it in an appropriate way to go ahead and protect our wildlife and our domestic resources and not have to step up into trying to develop a regulatory program, because that, you know, regulatory programs are expensive issues to go ahead and develop with respect to for having government oversight on those things.
I can imagine. And that's what you were talking about before, Amy, was the cost.
Yeah, and you have to look at the cost and the benefits and, you know, enforcing regulations, mandatory testing, some of these other things. There would be a cost on the farmer. There would be cost on the state. You know, who's going to enforce it? And as we all know right now, budget issues are important.
Right. You know, I was reading about this the last couple of days, and the thing that popped into my mind, the only thing I can think of similar was, and I think Dr. Gerlach mentioned brucellosis, but I remember hearing about these outbreaks in the lower 48 when I was a kid, you know, it was back in the 70s or something, and reading about it. Anthrax, I think, and it was... worried that it would go from either bison to buffalo or buffalo to bison. I couldn't remember which, but is this sort of the same situation? Is it that dangerous comparatively? Or that not dangerous? Dire? I don't know what the word is.
Well, I think you bring up a really good point, Jay, in the fact that those two diseases that you mentioned, brucellosis and anthrax, not only affect animals, but they have a very significant public health threat and impact on human beings, because both those diseases can cause severe illness and death in people. And so when you look at the perspective of what disease or pathogens that are of concern, is you have to go through a rating process to see, you know, what this pathogen would, how many animals would this impact, what are the consequences, and then how do you go ahead about to try to control it? It's a very involved and complex problem to deal with.
Can this go in both directions? Can a wild animal contract it from a domesticated animal and then pass it on to a completely different domestic goat or sheep?
I think Dr. Gerlach can clarify if I'm wrong, but I believe, you know, it can pass both ways.
Mm-hmm. So there's it's like the flu vaccine. It's best when everybody gets the flu shot because it just protects the population. This is something that can spread in both directions. Does that make you worried?
Well, but there's also, you know, Dr. Gerlach mentioned that there's different strains. You know, is it a pathogen that's just there, not causing any harm? You know, what are the different virulence of the different strains? And I believe, you know, there an animal can hold it in their nasal swabs are one of the testing methods, nasal swab and then blood sample. But can they carry it in their nose and then expel it and be done with it? Or, you know, so there's different things to consider, not just if they have it, they're going to get sick.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. And that's a really good point, because when you look at even with the flu, and we'll take just the human flu, and because there's flu in dogs and cats and horses and pigs and birds. But if you look at the human flu virus, and the fact that you and Amy are in the studio there and close to each other, if one of you did have the flu, just because Amy was there, it doesn't mean that she's going to go ahead and pick up the flu. It would depend on how close she is, how much of a dose that the another person is expelling, and how, if that virus, once it gets around Amy, can go ahead and establish its residency, and then, you know, fight off the local body defenses and then cause illness. And so just because you're in a room with somebody who has the cold or the flu doesn't mean you're going to get it. And so there's a number of factors that look at you have to look at when you look at trying to control this and what's the overall threat to the population.
So if I have a friend, say Bob, he's got a goat in his yard, fenced yard, wanders around, should he be worried about his livestock? Or, I mean, assuming it's not a pet, I guess. Even if it is a pet. Even more so, maybe. But, I mean, Amy, is this something that
and the wildlife-livestock interaction issue is always going to, I mean, it's there. It's always going to come up, not just MOV. Farmers don't want wildlife coming through there. You know, they can ruin fences. They can eat the hay. They can... And there is the concern of parasites or pathogens passing back and forth. So, you know, a farmer typically doesn't want wildlife in with their livestock.
Sure.
And not just, I mean, any number of lice or whatever other pathogens or parasites are out there.
So if somebody's a casual goat owner, maybe they own one of those fainting goats and they just like to say boo-boo to it all the time. What I hear both of you saying here is that just because it's out there doesn't mean every goat is going to get it and die.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's another good point for discussion is the fact that sheep and goat owners, just like any farmer, would have they have an investment in their animals. And from the perspective of a production standpoint, you don't want to have any illness or pathogen get in there that's going to impact your animals, either to cause less of a product at the end that you're going to sell, so it would impact your profit for your farm, or, you know, cause death and loss of that animal. and that gets back to then, you know, you don't want to, you want to be able to take care of those animals in the best possible fashion to make sure that they're going to grow and be healthy. And that's where every farmer has a, you know, a plan, a health plan for their animals, just like you have for your kids. Your health plan, your dental health plan for your kids is you take them in once or twice a year for the dentist to check to make sure there's not a problem. And then you try, you know, to brush your teeth and avoid sweets and all those things. With a farmer and sheep and goats is that they say, well, I have X number of animals and I'm trying to go ahead and protect them from illness and disease. So if I want to go ahead and try to limit access that they have to other animals, whether they're wildlife or maybe other domestic animals. So maybe when a fair time comes and you're going to take some to the fair, that you're going to be very careful, making sure that when you bring them back home, because they've been around other animals, that you keep them isolated and maybe even test them before mixing them back into your flock or your herd to be sure that you're not bringing something new back in. And so those herd health plans are very important with respect to maintaining that a good husbandry on your farm as well as protecting your investments.
It's about 11:31. We're talking about the MOV bacteria. They call it MOVI. Not to be confused with Moby. I mistyped Moby and typed Moby, and I got the EDM singer. but Mycoplasma ovi pneumonia, which infects ovines, goats and sheep, and apparently caribou?
Yeah, we're finding moose and caribou and bison, and down in the States, I think mule deer and white-tailed deer, I believe, have also tested positive. So, you know, we're finding out it reaches more.
Mm-hmm. Now, is it because we were talking about the strains, and you mentioned, Amy, that, you know, they found a caribou with it, or was it a reindeer? Caribou, probably.
I believe it was a caribou.
Yeah. Here in Alaska, is there a critical mass of animals that need to have it before it gets spread? Is that a question for Bob?
That might be a question. I don't know that there is a magic number or...
Yeah. Bob,
I think it might have more to do with the health of the animal on whether or not, how it's going to affect them.
Oh. So, okay, I'm going to get back to that. Bob, what do you think? Are we anywhere near a critical mass on this, or is this something that doesn't need a certain percentage of the population to have it before it becomes a greater problem?
Well, that's a good point for discussion in the fact that it was assumed that when this mycoplasma was introduced into a population, what it does to the animal is that it gets into the nasal passages and then can get down deeper into the air passages and in the lung. And when it gets in there, it causes a paralysis of the cilia that we have lining the inside of our respiratory tract. And that cilia helps move the mucus lining that's there as a protective layer. So when you breathe in, you may breathe in particles of dust and debris as well as other pathogens. It attaches to that mucus layer, and then the cilia push it up, and then you cough it or expel it out of your airways and as protection. So the mycoplasma ovi pneumonia paralyzes the cilia, and so we don't have a way to clean out our lungs, have our natural defenses working. And then if other bacteria or viruses get into our lungs or into the lungs of the animal, then it gives them a better opportunity to grow and populate and then cause an illness. And that's what we are seeing when you end up having a population that gets impacted or sickened by exposure to the mycoplasma ovi pneumonia. Generally, there is not just the mycoplasma there. There are other bacteria and pathogens, whether bacteria and viruses, as well as there's other stressors on that animal. So if you have an animal that's pretty healthy and there's obviously bacteria all around us all the time, so if they're healthy and they get exposed, their chances of getting the illness may be pretty low. But if you go ahead and stress them and that they don't have good grazing or they don't have access to water, or maybe they're not in the best of health condition or there's some other stress. They just had the female just had a gave birth to young, and so those other stressors can then cause that tip that balance to make them more likely to go ahead and get this pneumonia as a result of exposure. And to make the point is that we have, there have been studies in the lower 48 with certain populations of bighorn sheep that have mycoplasma of pneumonia circulating within their populations, but they don't see the morbidity and mortality events or the illness that they see in other areas. So it's a very complex and combination of things that result in not just exposure, but these other stressors to go ahead and cause the pneumonia to occur.
Ah, Amy, that speaks to what you were saying earlier, that if the animal has got it but otherwise healthy.
Yeah, you may not see effects.
Yeah. And so does that make the Farm Bureau folks optimistic that this isn't going to become sort of a feedback loop between domestic ovines and wild ungulates?
Yeah, I mean, I think we just want to find out more. I mean, I wouldn't say that we're chewing our fingernails, but yeah, just going through the process of finding out what is out there is mm-hmm. important.
It sounds like if I don't know, let's say you had a cold in September and didn't get a flu shot, and then you got the flu, you're more likely to have a bad flu. Is that? It sounds like if you're not healthy, something bad has a better chance of infecting you. Is that what you're saying, Dr. Gerlach?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So it happens every fall when we have our kids that they're playing all summer and they all of a sudden go back to school. And so we put them all in the classroom, and they're really a big population of kids all close together, so they have increased contact with one another. And then the fact that you have a different schedule and routine for the family as well as the kids is they're under a greater stress. And so guess what happens? We see an increased number of respiratory illnesses and colds occur in that situation. And so that combination of things has to go through to go ahead and do that. So when we look at the issue with domestic animals and wild wildlife, is that it's not just Mycoplasma of pneumonia that the agricultural community and the wildlife folks are worried about. They're worried about a number of other pathogens like parasites and other viruses that, in addition to other bacteria, that could cause a problem. So our goal then is to go ahead and keep our animals healthy, our livestock healthy, try to keep them separated from these other susceptible populations of wild animals, and work at that to go ahead and mitigate the risk, not just of mycoplasma, but these other pathogens as well.
So general livestock hygiene.
Yeah, yeah. And, like for me, whether it's meat or wool, the healthier my sheep are, the less I have to interact, the less money it takes to keep their weight on or have a nice strong fiber, or so I always want to keep my animals healthy.
So once you heard about this, did you check any of your animals, or you just keep an eye on them for sneezing?
I did participate in the study.
Okay, tell me about that. What did it involve, and how long did it take, and what kind of answers did you get?
and the study's still ongoing, so we haven't got, I think we've gotten the test results from the nasal swabs, but we set it up as a confidential study. So, one of the concerns from producers was they don't want their name out there in the public. They don't want people to get access to their, if they've tested, or find out where they are, what their test results were, because it is a pretty heated discussion with some other groups. So it was a confidential test. You had to have a vet come out three different times about a month apart to do. The first one was nasal swabs and a blood sample. And then the next two times were just nasal swabs. And, you know, they got shipped off to the lab to get tested, and then you would get your results back.
How'd your critters turn out? This dramatic pause makes me think, oh no, you had to cull your herd.
No, oh, good. No. And you know, whether an owner had positives or not, you know, there were no requirements to cull. And that's one of the questions is, you know, if you cull an animal because it was positive, does that mean you're not going to get it again? Or, you know, management is one thing that we don't have an answer to yet on how they get it in the first place.
Wow. I'm speaking with Amy Seitz, the president of the Alaska Farm Bureau and state veterinarian.
Executive director.
Oh, executive director.
I don't want to take the president's.
I'd rather be an executive director, too. And state veterinarian Dr. Bob Gerlach. We're talking about bacterium mycoplasma ovi pneumonia, or MOV, or MOVI bacteria, which it has in the lower 48, I guess, ravaged wild and domestic populations, and we're hoping it doesn't happen here.
Yeah, and down in the western states, the bighorn sheep have been affected. But again, is it you have to look at the whole picture, and it's not just MOV being out in the population, but look at all the other stressors on them.
Right. Dr. Gerlach, have we seen any indications that it's more than one caribou? And where did you find this caribou that got it?
Well, you bring up a good point I wanted to make was the fact that the study that we're doing here in Alaska is kind of groundbreaking in a way in especially the wildlife part of the study, in the fact that there'll be a paper, it should be out in print probably in the next month or so, showing the first time that the presence of this mycoplasma ovi pneumonia in wildlife species other than the wild sheep and goats that have been identified in the past. And this is actually, like I say, big news and new findings. And so when you look at the overall overall wildlife study, I think so far Dr. Beckman and the wildlife biologists around the state have submitted, you know, over 650 samples in for from multiple different species, not just wild sheep and goats, but the other ungulates, like you said, and it's really coming up with some fascinating results. And I don't have the numbers of actually how many so far that they've identified as positive, but they have identified both wild sheep and goats across the state, and like me. Amy said in both moose and some caribou in different areas of the state.
How many potentially endangered and, you know, not extinction endangered, but at risk wild animals are there out there? I mean, is it all just in the urban-rural interface, you know, just the moose around populated farms, or
the wildlife that have tested positive range all across the state, and down at the peninsula, Matsu area, up to the Brooks Range.
Oh, so, really?
So having animals test positive up in the Brooks Range is I don't know if exciting is the correct word, but it is interesting since there are not domestics up there. So, you know, that's a question raised of where did they get it? Mm-hmm. And how long has it been there?
Well, that is a good question. Dr. Gerlach, is there an answer to that question?
Well, that's hopefully what the study will go ahead and help us determine, because with the not just the detection of it in these species, but with the genetic work that's going to be done with the USDA and in some other labs involved with this, they'll be able to identify, have these bacteria been circulating in wildlife and before introduction of domestic animals, and that'll be something that we're really waiting and anxious to go ahead and find out the results of that of that study. And like I said, it's just like with any of these studies, you try to go ahead and get an adequate number of samples, and then you have to wait, kind of put an end to collections, do all the, not only just the identification of the presence or absence of the bacteria, but also then the genetic testing. And the genetic testing is extremely time-consuming and involved, that will take a bit of time to go ahead and go through. And with our domestic animal study, I think it's showing some new findings as well. I mean, so far we've tested over 650 individual domestic sheep and goats in the state, and have had, you know, good news with respect to not finding a very high prevalence of that bacteria within our populations. I mean, we're seeing about a 4% of the animals impacted or being detected with the mycoplasma in their nasal passages. And so far, all the animals that we've detected it in, none of them have been sick, and none of the farms that have had detections have had any type of illness or problems on their farms. So that portrays what we normally see in our domestic species, is that if they're under good management and don't have a high exposure to this, they're not under a lot of stress, it generally doesn't cause any severe illness in our domestic animals. And the concern for the wildlife is that they don't have the same immune response to these pathogens, and so oftentimes they become more susceptible to getting an illness and having a negative impact from that exposure and illness.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Gerlach, I meant to ask you this earlier when Amy had mentioned the regulations, the thoughts of regulations back in 2016, fences and all this testing. Have you found that goat farmers are generally agreeable on this? How what's your relationship been with them?
Well, this study has gotten us to get out and do a lot more outreach and interaction with the farms. So far, we've been to either our office with us or with veterinarians who've been helping with the study to collect samples. We've gotten samples from about 43 farms, so that's quite a good number. When we look at the USDA that does their farm census every 5 years, in fact, we're going through one now. But the last one that was done was in 2012, and they determined there were about just a little over 100 farms, sheep and goat farms in the state. And so when we look at, we're almost to half of the farms that we've tested, and they were calculating that at that time period that there may be about 1,400 sheep and goats in the state. And so if we even up that, saying, well, since that time period, maybe we have over 2,000 because of increased number of farms around the state and increased interest in sheep and goats, that the fact that we've got over 650 samples means that we've got a good representative sample of the population here. And like I say, the good news is that it's a very low prevalence and that we're not seeing any impact of this pathogen on our domestic animals.
And I think an interesting point on the results of the study that we're seeing is the positive the 4 to 5% positive domestic animals that we've seen. Only a handful of them, a few, have tested positive on all three rounds. So it's not even a consistent positive testing on an animal,
wow,
which I found interesting.
Yeah. What accounts for that? Like the MOVI bacteria is just in the nose one time and not present at all in another test? Or?
I think Dr. Gerlach might be better.
Dr. Gerlach, is that common? Do you see that? I imagine that's why there are a series of tests that are needed, right?
Well, yeah, that's really a good point to make, and the fact that just like with any other bacteria that we have, in our environment, in a population, that they'll be it'll be passed around. And whether it's going to cause an illness is whether there's these other stressors involved. But, you know, I may get exposed to maybe a strep bacteria, and we do a culture in my nose, and then next week I don't have it there. But then I go to a meeting, or I go to a go out to a restaurant, and I come back, and I swab again, and I've got exposed to it again because somebody else had it and passed it on. But so it, and then our bodies get rid of it. But there are certain people, just like certain animals, that can be the Typhoid Mary or the carrier that has the illness, or has the, I shouldn't say illness, but has the pathogen, but's not sick. And they just shed it out to everybody else, and they're the ones that you know, help keep that bacteria circulating throughout the population all the time.
You mentioned other stressors on animals a couple of times. I'm wondering, is climate change a stressor, or do you anticipate it to be a stressor soon? You know, warming, I imagine.
Yes, I think that's a very good point. And I think that's why oftentimes that we're seeing maybe an increased number of these sporadic outbreaks in the lower 48, as we see the overall land that these wild sheep have for their habitat is shrinking down because of urban expansion, and then because of the climatic changes that are going on down there. A number of states have been, for the last 15 years, have gone through drought issues, and so that causes a greater stressor on the animals. One is they might not have access to water. They might not have as well watered and nutritious browse to go ahead and eat. And so those are things that can cause some pretty big impacts, as well as climate change can go ahead and have different populations of animals have to move from habitat to habitat and maybe crowd on in each other. So there's a lot of things that that can impact that, and that's an interesting point that I think the wildlife folks and in both the state as well as federal agencies are looking at to try to assess and make adequate management changes to go ahead and lessen that impact.
We only have a minute or two left here. Doctor, maybe I can ask you if there are any last thoughts or what the most important thing our listeners should take away from this conversation.
I think one of the very important facts is that we have a constant threat of different pathogens, and that the best way that we can work toward trying to lessen their impact is going to be from this One Health aspect. That's where, especially because about 70% of these pathogens that we look at not just don't stay in animals, but they can affect human beings. So we have to be able to look at our animal health, our environmental health, and human health, and see how they interact so that we can go ahead and make sure that we're not doing something in one area that may have a negative impact on another. I think it's very much a need for collaboration among agencies and among different fields of study, as well as looking at basing our actions on science and facts so that we can have a full understanding and that we don't necessarily jump to conclusions that maybe can have a very negative impact on a number of different things.
Okay. Amy, let me ask you specifically. Last summer I spent a couple of months in the lower 48. My dad's family was from Wyoming, so ranches, farms, all around mm-hmm. there. And limited wildlife. And, you know, I was talking with my cousins down there about all this stuff, and ranchers and wildlife have not always been friends.
And yeah, I think a part of it is how the discussion started. You know, I know just the sheep and goat issue specifically, you know, they've been dealing with it for about 20 years, is my understanding. And it's, there hasn't been the collaboration to, you know, mm-hmm. to get the information. So
Are you seeing, it sounds like ranchers and wildlife here, ranchers being members of the Farm Bureau, I guess, that have goats and such, this doesn't seem to be as cutthroat and intensive as the range wars, for example.
Yeah, and maybe because it hasn't been going on as long, but it is definitely, there can be heated discussion. I mean, it's a controversial issue. Not the agencies. You know, Fish and Game has been great to work with. Dr. Gerlach has been great to work with. But the different organizations, the Wild Sheep Foundation and the Farm Bureau, we've gone head-to-head a little bit over this issue, and the various livestock owners. But we just want to be able to come at it reasonably.
You're not interested in letting your animals die off.
Right.
Yeah.
I also don't want to be overregulated.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think the importance of looking at the risk and cost and getting the answers, not just having a knee-jerk reaction because we think something might happen.
Well, I think that's one of the things I learned today here is that, you know, it's not just one thing that's going to take down, you know, the peninsula's moose herd.
Yeah.
Population.
Yeah, and I know, yeah, the ranchers down in the western states, they've gone through, I don't know, three or four different pathogens that, you know, they were told it's because of the domestic sheep and goats, and it's this pathogen that they're giving to the wildlife. Well, then, you know, you turn around and now it's a different pathogen. And so, you know, taking those steps and regulating based on what they know now, mm-hmm. instead of let's get the answers and then figure out how to work together.
Yeah. Well, Amy Seitz, Executive Director of the Alaska Farm Bureau, thank you very much for coming in. And Dr. Bob Gerlach, State Veterinarian, thank you very much for joining us on the phone.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks so much, Jay.
Yes, right. Thank you for speaking with us.
KDLL Public Radio provides the news, interviews, features, and entertainment programming you trust from around the world and right here at home. Do you value local, responsible reporting? Or diverse music brought to you by your friends and neighbors? How about in-depth shows that are unique to your community? Then please support KDLL. We can't continue to bring you the local programming you enjoy without your support. Please visit kdll.org and click the donate button today.